The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Jack Midgley. Jack is a managing director for Deloitte's Tohmatsu's Asia-Pacific Defense Consulting practice. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Roger. It's always nice to see you.
Yeah, well, it's great to see you back in town. I know you are located in Tokyo, and you are a global traveler and been, you know, recently, I think you've been to Norway. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
So talking about Norway's defense posture as well. So I'm very fortunate, and I think listeners are very fortunate to have you stop by D.C. and have the opportunity to have you talk on the show. And today, I know one of the areas you guys are focusing on right now is the Internet of Things, and we'll get into that shortly. But first, the last time you were on, we talked somewhat about the conventional Internet Vulnerability Index and what that is or isn't. I think that's a great way to start the show, and just because people think about cyber and internet, and we can, you know, transition to the Internet of Things. But just what's that? What is that conventional vulnerability index with regard to the internet, and how'd you guys come up with that?
Well, cyber is such a big topic that it's difficult for people to get their heads around specific threats and challenges, and we've come at this from a policy direction, not so much from a direction of technology. And as we thought about this for our defense clients, we wanted to get an understanding of how big the threat is. So our first thought was, let's see if we can count the number of cyber attacks that happen in the world. And because we're not a government organization, we have to use public data.
Right.
So we went around and looked for ways to count a cyber attack. And what we discovered is that there's no agreed upon measure of what's a cyber attack. So a data theft, some people count as a cyber attack. But other organizations like software companies even count spam emails as cyber attacks.
Really?
So it just wasn't a very satisfying exercise. So instead of trying to count attacks, we decided to turn the telescope around, and we said, let's count targets. And let's see if we can figure out how many targets there are that might be open to internet attack, to cyber attack, in different countries around the world. And by using public data, which is what we have to do, we decided to construct an index. And what we counted as targets were, in each country, how many people use the internet. How many people have fixed broadband connections? How many broadband connections are there? How many mobile internet subscribers? And how many secured internet servers? The reason we picked those variables is that you can get public data for all the countries that are interesting around the world and also over long periods of time. So we put an index together and counted these up. When we did, I think we were really surprised at what we found.
Yeah, just real quickly, I want to touch the thing that when we talked about it before that really struck me was, you know, the difference in the index with the placement of the United States versus, for example, China in terms of, you know, based on that sort of gross measure that you used, right? You know, U.S. was much more vulnerable than the Chinese with regard to the
I think that was the big surprise for us. What our index appears to show is that there is a small group of very well-developed economies, South Korea, the Nordic countries, and also the United States, that are more than 10 times, present more than 10 times as many targets on the internet as do countries like China, Russia, Iran, India, and so forth. So coming at this as a defense problem, what we learned is that there's an asymmetry. So the developed countries present very attractive targets for cyber attack. the other countries with a lower exposure to internet are remarkably less visible on the commercial internet. And what that tells us is countries that adopt a policy of proportionate response in cyberspace may be heading for failure, may be heading for trouble.
Because there's not as many targets.
Because there's not that much to shoot back
at.
That also means that if you're China, if you're Russia, it makes really good military sense to build up offensive cyber capability.
Right.
It's in, because it's an area where you can strike with
and
relative
economic
impunity.
Sense too, right?
You can cause damage. You can cause disruption. You can cause political turmoil and loss of public confidence in ways that don't expose the attacker's country.
Right.
So we think that that asymmetry is an issue for public policy, and it's not one that, at least in our view, most of the Western governments have successfully addressed. Everyone wants to keep cyber in the box and to say, look, if we're attacked in cyberspace, we're going to make a measured and proportional response. Well, that policy position doesn't appear to line up with the real geography of cyberspace. And it leaves the West open to attack, I think.
That's fascinating stuff. And yeah, building on the Internet Vulnerability Index, you guys are now working on a what I guess is called Project Icebox. Can you talk a little bit about what that? And we're going to turn now to you're working on an Internet of Things Vulnerability Index.
I'm happy to. When we showed the Internet Index to our defense clients, we tended to get the same question, which is, okay, fine, you've told us about the commercial internet, but we're worried about this new and very rapidly growing Internet of Things, which is completely different from the commercial internet. And we'd like to understand how exposed are we there?
Right.
I'm
sorry, Jack. So first, what is the Internet of Things?
Yeah, that's a good place to start, actually. The Internet of Things is the Internet of Connected Devices. It's everything from refrigerators and cars, but importantly, also things like building automation systems, commercial machines and commercial infrastructure that relies on computer input to operate. And, of course, that's everything.
Right.
Yeah. But also municipal infrastructure, traffic control systems. All of these kinds of devices are now being connected to the internet. And although that connection creates convenience and a lot of economic advantages, the flip side is that it can also open those devices to exploitation and attack. So just as we did with the commercial internet, we tried to approach the Internet of Things as a defense problem, not as a technical problem, but as a problem for defense authorities.
Right. Well, even when you're listing the different things, the one thing that came to mind to me is hospitals and medical equipment. Right. They're connected increasingly to the internet as well, and they're part of that target base as well, it seems to me.
Absolutely, they're part of it. And not just the devices in the hospital, but the building itself, the environmental controls, the power, elevators, air conditioning, all of those kinds of systems are now being wired up in ways that allow them to be controlled by computer, but also expose them to the internet.
So what the practical impact that you shut off, you turn off the environmental systems, you can really wreck, create chaos.
It's not hard to see that. The, for example, to go back to the building automation example, if those systems can be reached, they can be turned off, They can be manipulated. People can be locked out of those systems. So, for example, in an extreme case, one can imagine an office tower in which power and air handling systems were turned off or made inoperable. Elevators were made to stop operating. That would make the building uninhabitable. You don't have to attack it with a truck bomb. If you can make the building unusable with a computer, you can achieve the same kind of result.
Yeah, it's almost like you just have just these things, thoughts pop in. It's like the neutron bomb of cyber, right? You don't damage anything, right? But you
the building
you
still
just shut
stands,
it down. Yeah, it's
but
still,
you can't use.
I mean,
it.
It's not the same, but you know what I mean.
I do understand. Yeah.
So that's my crazy mind and the analogies. But you know, Jack, we're already up on the first break. When we come back, I'd like to talk a little about, you know, where the targets are around the globe and start talking about the index and what you're finding with regard to who's vulnerable, who's not. And then, of course, the big picture is what does that mean from a policy perspective, from a defense posture perspective for, you know, for various countries. My guest today is Jack Midgley. He is a managing director for Deloitte Tohmatsu's Asia-Pacific Defense Consulting Practice, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jack Midgley. He is a managing director in Deloitte Tohmatsu's Asia-Pacific Defense Consulting Practice, and we're talking cyber, we're talking the Internet of Things, we're talking about the Internet of Things Vulnerability Index. I'm having a real hard time saying that today, Jack. Maybe I'm scared. I don't know. this segment, I think, you know what, you know, we sort of set the stage and talked about what the Internet of Things is and why it's, you know, and what the targets of opportunity. Let's explore. I like the term the geography of the Internet of the cyber world, and that means like where are, you know, these targets in the Internet of Things and how are they globally distributed? So can go at it. Let us know.
That geography is interesting and it's complicated. We divided up the world into three kinds of targets on the Internet of Things. The first set was building automation, the systems that operate commercial buildings and homes. The second set was industrial targets. Those are the systems that turn machinery on and off and that operate plants, that control fuel tanks, that sort of thing. The third set of targets was communications infrastructure, things like the wireless router that you have at home. All of those, each of those sets of targets is potentially accessible to an attacker. So our first question was, where are these targets and how many of them are there? And we were shocked to discover that you can actually find these targets through commercial search engines on the Internet. Anyone can do it. And frankly, you
Wow.
shouldn't be able to see these at all.
Wow.
But when we looked, for example, for building automation systems, we picked a few particular types, and we found over 30,000 exposed systems worldwide. We found over 55,000 industrial automation systems, including fuel tank controls, furnace operations, all sorts of industrial systems, and over 37,000 internet-exposed communication systems, including VoIP telephone systems, routers, and so forth. In most cases, when we found these systems, they told us what they are, where they are, what city and their geolocation, uh-huh. their internet protocol address, the IP address. And in most cases, they also invited us to log in. Now, we don't do that, but a malicious actor could. And every one of these targets pops up on a simple internet search. There are search engines available for the Internet of Things, just as Google is available for the indexed internet. So these are not hard to find. So to understand kind of where these targets were, we then analyzed them by country, which country has the most. And because countries are at different stages of economic development, we take the total number of targets and we divide it by the size of the economy. And that gives us a sense for how exposed each economy is on the Internet of Things. And our the answer, again, was very surprising. There are basically two groups of countries. One group that is far above the average in terms of its exposure, and the other far below. The countries that
So there's nobody really in the middle, huh?
There weren't a lot right in the middle.
Right.
No, they tended to group.
That's interesting. And,
The ones that were very highly exposed included the Baltic countries, some of the Nordic countries. The United States was actually about 14th in 14th place on our list of over 100 countries. So
why do you think that is? Because people would, you know, we would think, well, we're the most advanced.
We are. You know, we're pretty advanced, but per unit of GDP, less so.
That's the
and because the economy is so big. So countries like Norway, Sweden, the Netherlands. Are closer to the top of the vulnerability list. The countries that are least exposed included India, China, Iran, Russia, Saudi Arabia, but also Japan, Germany, and Korea. So you know, why is that?
Yeah, it's because when
you would think they would be right at the top.
Absolutely.
Well, you know that. We're trying to unpack this,
yeah.
But our current thinking is that countries, in particular like Japan, simply take a different approach to this kind of software. A lot of the building automation systems and industrial automation systems in Japan, for example, are manufactured locally by Japanese companies, and they are not left open to the internet in ways that Western industrial companies do. The basic reason why you can find these systems is that when software companies put them in, they leave open a port. They leave open a little access way so that the systems can be repaired and upgraded. Well, the same door that the maintenance man uses can be used by a burglar.
Right, sure.
And
you don't lock that door, you're in trouble.
If you don't lock that door, then the burglar can come in. And we think that's what's taking place. So the landscape of the Internet of Things shows a surprising degree of vulnerability by the large developed economies, and a much lower degree of vulnerability by those countries that are in earlier stages of economic development, but also the extractive economies that don't depend so heavily on these on the Internet. That's why Saudi Arabia, for mm-hmm. example, and Iran are close to the bottom. But the picture that emerges is very troubling because just as we saw on the commercial internet, there is an asymmetry. Countries at the top of the vulnerability list, primarily Western, are many times more exposed on the Internet of Things than the countries that are building offensive cyber capabilities like China, Iran, and Russia. And that invites some attention from a defense perspective.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, and you mentioned Saudi Arabia. I'm wondering, is there and I know it probably would be really hard to do, but you know, just the relative importance to a particular economy of a particular target. I mean, that would factor into someone's. I mean, and that probably is a challenge that's really would be tough. But for example, in Saudi Arabia, right, if the industrial infrastructure is all connected to the internet and it's, you know, they're refining or pumping oil and you hurt that, you shut down that country literally from an economic perspective.
There's no doubt. Yeah. And some of the targets.
Is that something I assume that strategists look at all that. Is there?
Well, of course, and we're just counting the number of
targets. I know.
That's just
kind of
someone's
taking
measure.
A filter to it
it's
after
right.
that. Right.
But you're right to say, you know, there's certain critical infrastructure, power plants, locks and dams, internet gateways that are clearly more important. And those are the places where the Western governments in particular have focused their cyber attention. So we're actually pretty good at protecting because there's policy in place and authorities in place to do it. So critical infrastructure has been a close focus of U.S. And NATO and other countries' cyber policy. We're talking about systems that don't rise to the level of critical infrastructure.
Right.
They are literally below the radar of the current cyber authorities. But growth in this area is explosive.
Yeah.
And the number, the sheer number of these targets and the nature of them invites, we think, invites attack, and it might also invite more attention than it's getting on the policy side.
Right. And it's like a real, it seems to me, when you think about, it's just the momentum and the number of targets is just going to increase as we get to, you know, driverless cars, for example, it seems to me, or even cars today connect to the internet, right? You know, and, you know, I'm thinking of the horror stories that, you know, your house is connected to the internet, like folks in their refrigerators even, or, you know, turning off the light on the lights or on, off the lights and alarm systems and all kinds of things. You could really just create the effects that it would have it just seems to me that the momentum on this is just going to, you know, exponentially increase as it just becomes the technology and connection to internet becomes more pervasive. Is that, I mean, as you guys look at that, do you see, you know, how do you, can you measure sort of trends like of adoption or the growth in the number of, you know, items that are connected to the internet? Is that?
Those are great points. We didn't, our Icebox study did not look at internet-connected vehicles because the numbers are still really small.
Yeah,
And those are concentrated in a relatively small number of countries. Clearly, there's growth. It's not yet explosive or exponential, but there's growth there. Where we see huge growth in adoption and where there's already a lot of targets is building automation and industrial automation.
Yeah.
The building automation market will reach tens of billions of dollars in the next 5 or 6 years. These systems are being brought online as fast as companies can do it. But also city infrastructure is increasing. It's just at the takeoff point now, but that's being increasingly automated. And by city infrastructure, I mean even things like traffic control systems that switch stoplights on and off. Those technologies have been adopted in a few hundred cities worldwide, but when they're adopted in thousands of cities worldwide, we're going to see the same kind of vulnerability that we see here.
Right.
So we focused on those three target sets, buildings, commercial, and communications infrastructure, because there's a lot of them today. There's a lot of them to count. And we thought we'd get a better sense of the current state of vulnerability by looking there.
Right.
When we repeat this analysis a few more years from now, I think we'll be looking at things like refrigerators and connected cars.
Right. Jack, we do have to take our next break. My guest today is Jack Midgley. He is Managing Director for Deloitte Tohmatsu's Asia-Pacific Defense Consulting Practice. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the, you know, the policy issues and the technological challenges of this and where we go from here. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Fed News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Fed News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jack Midgley. He is Managing Director for Deloitte Tohmatsu's Asia-Pacific Defense Consulting Practice, and we're talking the Internet of Things, the Internet of Things Vulnerability Index, and what it means for, you know, policymakers, for countries, how, you know, what the profile is and what the potential. And now we're going to get into some of the also interesting stuff. We've laid the groundwork, right, Jack, and described the challenges and issues. And so what do we do about them? And, you know, what from a policy perspective / technical perspective, you know, how do you address these things? And, you know, can you talk a little bit first, like the, you know, the policy challenges versus the technical challenge, and I guess the relative, you know, which is more daunting, and then we can get into some further discussion and peel back the onion on some of that.
Well, there are both technical and policy challenges here, but there's so much investment going into the development of cyber response tools and diagnostic tools that our sense is that the technology has actually outraced the policy, and that around the Internet of Things, governments, in particular Western governments, face really serious challenges because these systems tend to be owned in the private sector and because they aren't part of a nation's critical infrastructure. So, you know, the systems that work an elevator in an office building downtown don't rise to the level of critical infrastructure, but they can be attacked. In the United States, the latest policy is set out in Presidential Policy Directive 41, which came out over the summer. And it lays out very clearly, you know, who's responsible for response to attacks against critical infrastructure or government systems. So, you know, the Department of Justice has a role, the FBI has a role, the Office of National Intelligence has a role. Those are all clearly specified. But the same directive also makes clear that business, you know, commercially owned systems are outside the purview of the government.
Sure,
and
yeah.
We rely on voluntary action to deal with those systems. That's how a free country operates. The Chinese, on the other hand, don't have those restrictions. So last year's information security law in China allows the government to collect information about these private systems, and it requires that building owners or building operators report cyber incidents directly to the PLA, the People's Liberation Army. We can't do that in the United States, and it's not clear the Chinese can actually do it. But the Chinese policy approach is much more in tune with the reality of the Internet of Things than the Western policy approaches.
I have to ask you real quick before you go. Sorry to interrupt, but it seems to me that the Chinese policy position or the directive, not only is it help them defend, but it seems to me that they're to the extent it works, they're collecting a lot of information about systems that presumably, you know, foreign companies may have,
yes,
you know, software. I mean, it's
right.
An information data gathering for them,
yeah,
on you know, capabilities and systems and software as well, right?
Well, I mean, that's true.
Yeah.
And it clearly has intelligence value. It's intended to have intelligence value. But the gaps that are created because of the way we have to approach this problem, those gaps are really serious. And at the most basic level, we think there are questions about whether the United States government or Western governments could even become aware that attacks are occurring against the Internet of Things in enough time to do anything about it. For example, if a building system is attacked, the building operator isn't required to report to the police or to the army. We don't work that way. In fact, he has an incentive not to report, because he doesn't want to cause panic. And if he does report, he's likely to call the software vendor, not
right,
the national authorities. So if 100 of these attacks are going on across the country at one time, there may be some help desks that are overworked, but such an attack could go on for days before the machinery of the federal government even became aware. And that's likely to come through interaction between local police and the FBI before they even become aware that an attack is underway. Once the government is aware, the second challenge is who convenes, who gets together to even plan a response in a situation where there are private actors, public actors, and potentially military actors like the National Guard CERT teams or other authorities. Who calls that meeting? Who has the authority to invite people to attend? What's the subject? And what decisions can they make? Those are open questions. Assuming that set of questions can be answered, then we have to think through what's the appropriate response. And this is where things get really problematic. Who prescribes that a particular action should be taken if the action has to occur on a private system? Can the government direct that actions be taken on a building system? And if it does, who pays? Who's responsible?
Right.
Does the insurance company pick up the tab?
Right.
I'm listing all these questions.
Yeah.
Because we're not getting real great answers.
No.
Not just in the United States, but as we talk about this around the world, most government people that we talk to are saying, look, we understand that there may be a problem here, but our focus now is on critical infrastructure and it's on government systems, and one can understand why that would be with limited resources. But the fact is that the growth area, the place where the risks are increasing the fastest, we think might very well be on the Internet of Things, which is being left relatively open. And where anything goes, there are no standards.
Right. Well, do you think you hit on my question? Is that, you know, to the extent part of the solution is developing standards or how you define things? I mean, for example, you talked about the critical infrastructure. Well, if I'm on the 100th floor of that building, the elevator's working is kind of critical to me, right? Is part of this. Is it a market driven solution in the sense that technology solves its problems across the board for those companies, or is it consensus building of standards that would apply for an operational guideline? I mean, I could see all these people at some point, somebody, because it boils down to money, saying, you got to come up with a process to deal with these things and address it, whether it's the insurance companies or whoever. I'm struggling, but it's such a daunting challenge to try to figure out how to organize, commercial enterprises to be able to respond to these things.
It is a daunting challenge. I don't think that we have to be prepared to surrender our rights of privacy or our ability to maintain our own information, though, to solve this problem. And there are analogies. One good analogy is earthquake protection. If you live in San Francisco or other cities where there's a fault line, there are government published standards that require certain construction practices that add a lot of cost to buildings.
Yep. Yeah.
But they keep the people inside safe.
Presumably, correspondingly, the insurance
keep
rates,
insurance
rates
a little bit better and so forth. Yeah, and it's an area where regulation, which is a dirty word sometimes,
yes,
where regulation in the public interest can have a really life-saving impact. Well, maybe it's time to start thinking about some of those regulations for internet-connected devices, for example, for starters. Why can a private consulting firm locate tens of thousands of building automation and factory automation systems on the internet and be invited to log in?
Right. That's my nervous laugh.
Well, I picked that right up. But, it doesn't that's excessive access, it seems to me. And, for starters, we could work on some ways to make those targets much less visible. Now, I guess that a determined adversary can still find a way in, but one easy and obvious place to start is to simply reduce the visibility of these systems. And that may just be a matter of more thoughtful design.
Right.
And it's an area where we think it might be useful to adopt some good regulations.
Right. Jack, we're up on our next break. Man, this is going fast. It's fascinating stuff. And you'll be able to read more about this in January of 2017. That's right, Jack. The Project Icebox will result in a report on the Internet of Things and a vulnerability index and these policy and technical challenges. I'm looking forward to reading that. I hope you send me a copy.
You'll get the first one.
Okay, and we can come back on the show and talk about it. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about looking forward. We're about to have an election here and some thoughts on, the priorities of the next administration potentially in this area and a couple others with regard to defense policy. My guest today is Jack Midgley. He is a managing director for Deloitte Tohmatsu's Asia-Pacific Defense Consulting Practice, and you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guest today is Jack Midgley. He is a managing director for Deloitte Tohmatsu's Asia Pacific Defense Consulting Practice, and we're talking about the Internet of Things, the Vulnerability Index, what it all means for nations, policymakers, and trying to protect our cyber infrastructure and keep our buildings, you know, functioning, and as well as our industrial infrastructure, and also, you know, folks, morale and just self-confidence. And we have a real-life example right now. We're getting ready to have the election shortly, a couple weeks or a week. And, you know, the email hacks and the use in those being released either has or haven't, depending on your perspective, had an impact on the American public and sort of self-confidence and just great angst out there, for lack of a better term, across various groups. That's a real-life example, Jack, and I think it's a good way to set up, you know, we will be transitioning to a new president, and in this area, in the cyber, Internet of Things, can you talk about what you think the new administration should be focusing on?
I liked your reference to, you know, the election infrastructure and voting machines and so forth, and it seems to me that there's two really basic lessons that bring that message and what we've discovered about the Internet of Things brings those together. And that is that as we move more and more of our personal and business and professional lives onto the Internet, it's a great source of convenience and economic advantage. And no one's going to slow that down. That's going to continue. The flip side of it is that convenience can also make us very vulnerable in new and unexpected ways. And that suggests that it's appropriate. In fact, it's necessary for governments to think about how to protect the population. This is a defense issue now. It's not just a technology issue. It's a matter for the national defense authorities and not just the police to think about. That fact of life, that's not going to change. And it suggests to us that maybe the next administration would keep a couple of things in mind. One is that regulation in this area could probably help a lot. A little bit of regulation, as we were talking about before the break, can go a long way if it keeps these devices from being detectable. Now, the engineers have to figure out how to do that. But standards that keep building automation systems from being casually observed on the commercial, you know, over the web.
Yeah, like you said, with the search engines.
Seems like a good idea. I got onto an elevator the other day, and it's a newer elevator, and it has a video screen in it. The video screen showed the IP address of the elevator. Now, who thinks that's a good idea? It's not a good idea. And, you know, who knows why an engineer decided to put that on there. But a standard that kept that kind of information from being publicly disclosed would be helpful. That's what I mean by regulation. I don't mean anything like the Chinese intrusion into the private lives of people. I'm talking about sensible regulations that limit the exposure of these systems to people who might wish us ill. That's one piece.
Okay.
The other challenge for the new administration is going to be that regulating the Internet of Things, protecting the Internet of Things, is a whole of government problem. In fact, it's a whole of nation problem. It doesn't just require interaction between defense and justice and homeland security. It requires the active participation of the private sector.
And state and local governments.
State and local government, exactly. Yeah. As these systems get more online. And cyber policy is still struggling, as you see in PD 41 last summer. Cyber policy is still struggling at the interagency level. So just laying things out like a peace treaty between ONI, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Homeland Security on who does what, right, in a critical infrastructure attack, that takes a presidential directive.
Yeah,
and there are good reasons why that's hard.
Yeah,
But this new problem, this IoT problem, goes way beyond simple interagency cooperation, and it's going to require very sophisticated interaction at very high speed among all of these different diverse agencies. And it seems to me we're going to either figure this out now or we're going to figure it out after a big attack. And I hope that the new administration is going to spend some time and some energy figuring it out now.
Right. It seems to me, you know, just listening to you, is that, you know, the current focus is, as you said, sort of within the federal government and dealing with critical infrastructure. And that's hard enough as it is, as you described, you know, figuring out a response and all that. Beyond that, that's going to be a huge challenge. Do they need a cyber czar or something?
I don't know about czars, but
just throw something out there.
It may need some legislation. Yeah. These are really hard problems. For example, the U.S. military can't respond.
Mm-hmm.
The active military can't respond to these emergencies inside the United States.
Right.
They have to do it through the mechanism of the National Guard. The National Guard requires activation by state governors. Coordinated action across multiple states can be very complicated, even in a hurricane, much less in a cyber attack. So getting the authorities clarified, getting the institutional machinery set up, that's really hard work.
Yeah.
And, of course, the government has started with critical infrastructure and getting the interagency.
Yep, absolutely.
You have to start with something.
Right. Absolutely.
I think we're calling attention to the fact that our enemies may not be waiting.
Mm-hmm.
And that as technology races ahead of policy, we're exposing the American economy and allied economies and friendly economies to threats and risks that are unlike anything we've seen before.
Yeah. I mean, you know, just thinking out loud is, you know, the federal government's role in regulating commerce. You know, the interstate commerce here is, you know, and rules around, you know, that will seems to me could be a logical avenue to provide some sort of baseline standards or regulations, whatever, for, you know, the Internet of Things and what you protect or not protect and what's required.
Well, so it's really not that different from airbags and seatbelts.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a great analogy. Yeah.
We know how to do this. We just haven't gotten around to doing it yet.
Right. Or fuel economy standards or things. I mean, just all kind. Yeah, I'm just thinking outside the box a little. So we have a couple minutes left, Jack, and you know, just more globally, when you think about, you know, the incoming administration, whoever it is, what they ought to be focusing on from a defense posture perspective for the United States. So is there anything that immediately comes to mind that needs care and feeding or attention, or is it just everything?
Well, it's always everything.
It's always everything.
Right. The crisis of the moment, whether it's Syria or Africa or what have you, can always grab attention. But as we talk with defense authorities around the world, one of the facts that seems clear to me is that people are really wrestling with what China represents. And, you know, is it a threat? Is it an opportunity? What are we supposed to be doing about China? So in, for example, in Africa, as the Chinese continue to raise their profile, Japan is beginning to think about how does it need to base more soldiers in Africa, where, what capabilities it's supposed to have. The Nordic countries are thinking about what does the Chinese presence in the polar region, what's that going to mean as their trade with the Chinese accelerates at a tremendous pace. You know, China's now got the second biggest defense budget in the world. It spends about a third of what the United States currently spends on defense, but that number's going to move north. It increasingly has power projection capabilities. It increasingly has space capabilities. In fact, while we're talking, there are two Chinese astronauts that got to the Tiangong space station on a Chinese vehicle. They were moved to space by their own. We can't do that. We have to rely on others to take us to space. So the Chinese technical capability is advancing very rapidly. And all of us who think about defense issues worldwide have to consider, what does this mean? Do we engage? Do we threaten? Do we negotiate? How do we deal with it? And I think that problem and the counterpart problem of revising our posture toward the Russians, those are going to be two huge defense challenges that the new administration will have to face, quite apart from issues of budget and current deployments.
Sure. Yeah. Great. That's a great way to end the show. I mean, it gives us a lot to think about, as always. You always do, Jack. I want to thank my guest today, Jack Midgley. He's a managing director for Deloitte Tohmatsu's Asia-Pacific Defense Consulting Practice. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.